Donald Trump's ban from Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, among others, has put private media groups under the spotlight. It has sparked questions about the power they hold over the public and the line between freedom of speech and censorship in the public interest.
Meanwhile, in the UK, Talk Radio's brief ban from YouTube made more headlines around social media's regulation and how big tech companies are behaving in the pandemic.
Today we will look at those issues and suggest the implications for the big media companies going forwards. To help us with that, we'll be chatting to Professor Charlie Beckett from the London School of Economics for his insight into recent events.
For the first time in 2021, I'm John Heumann.
And I'm Megan Boxall. Welcome to Not Your Normal Finance Show. Well, welcome back after a prolonged Christmas break from the podcast. I think we all had to take a little time to settle into lockdown number three and get going again with the podcast. But yeah, we're back hopefully now for the duration and lots to talk about this year, starting with the news, which is capturing headlines all over the place because it affects so many people. Everyone has an opinion on it. The banning of Donald Trump from many social media sites and what this means for social media going forward. To help us out, we're joined by Lauren Almeida again, who's our expert on all things modern, really, I suppose it is.
All things modern, yeah. Like computer games, yeah. And social media.
Yeah, that's not the extent of Lauren's skills, but that is where she helps us out. So thanks for joining us again, Lauren. To start us off, producer John has set us some questions, which I think we'll just take it in turns to answer because I think they're very good questions and it'll be good to see where we're all at. So question number one, Lauren, you can kick us off. Did the 7+ platforms that banned Donald Trump do the right thing?
It's a big question to start off with, isn't it? I suppose in one sense, it's almost like too little too late, right? Like the riots in Capitol Hill have already happened. The images that were coming out of Washington were really shocking a couple of weeks ago, people storming what was meant to be the symbol of American democracy. And the communities that organise that, whether that they're, you want to describe them as kind of alt-right or kind of fanatic Trump supporters, they've already formed those communities on Facebook and on Twitter and wherever else. So, in that sense, they've not done enough to address these issues and they've not done enough to potentially restrict what Trump was saying in the first place. But equally, you could argue that banning Trump, some people might say it was the right thing to do, but others would say, well, you censored the supposed leader of the free world. What are you going to do next? You have too much power. So in that sense, they've opened up themselves to a huge tidal wave of issues by essentially saying that they're now publishers and that they're going to have an editorial policy about kind of what's on their platform, what's allowed to be said.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely something that they must have seen these questions now coming down the road. But yeah, banning Trump seems to have been the catalyst. John, yes or no? Ban Trump from Twitter, etc.
No, I think it's really daft. I agree with most of in fact all of what Lauren said. He's a divisive character, but he does have an enormous following. I think he had something in excess of 80 million Twitter followers, and you know, a lot of people in the US voted for him, and those people are going to be very angry that he is banned from those platforms. It's hardly healing the division that we've seen in the United States, and it's not as though it's going to silence those groups anyway, because they will find somewhere else to go. And indeed they did. They'd all gone to another platform called Parler, which also then found itself essentially banned by various large tech companies, but now that's gone somewhere else. It's apparently set up shop on Russian servers. So it's really failed. It will fail, banning Trump, in respect of everything that it's trying to do.
Unless what it's trying to do is placate the incoming president, Joe Biden, who is maybe I don't even know if he's on Twitter, but he's he's definitely less active.
But that is interesting, though. And I think, Lauren, in fact, both of you, I think, when you were doing the US election series that we ran in the magazine, we did a big piece on political funding. And, you know, the Democratic Party and big tech are close. There
absolutely.
Is no doubt about it.
Yeah. And maybe in waiting until this point, which, I mean, I agree with Lauren, I think this is way too late if the censorship of these kind of views is the role of the social media companies. They should have done this years ago, but they've waited until Donald Trump's final few weeks in office, when really it's not going to have a particularly big impact on the companies themselves' profitability, because Trump, as of tomorrow, or today if you're listening to this tomorrow, is history. He's a part of American history, not a part of American present. And Joe Biden is the man in charge, so silencing Donald Trump, this is a big gesture, but really it doesn't mean an awful lot in terms of what people are picking up on Twitter, but it may mean an awful lot in terms of Twitter and Google and Facebook having a shoe in.
Yeah, but they may be sort of pleasing their Democrat paymasters. But Lauren, you alluded to it. You know, this potentially shows the world how powerful they actually are, and it shows the world that they're acting as publishers, as you said, which, you know, they had claimed not to be before. It changes the regulatory lens through which we potentially look at them, and that's potentially very bad news for investors.
Well, this leads us on to question two. So, Lauren, you can kick us off with this one as well. Should social media be self-regulated, or does it need an external body?
Well, I think the events of the past couple of weeks show that it does need an external body, because it can't regulate itself. It's not done a good enough job. Facebook has had like loads of people trying to monitor and get a grips on all of the, let's say, unsavory content on their platform. And the same for Twitter. And it's just not been successful, and it also means that both of those platforms have been used by domestic terrorists to organize in Washington. So I think it's kind of impossible to have, even if it's not social media regulating themselves, like, it's kind of impossible to have an independent regulatory body that can get its arms across all of the internet. Like, how do you control what people say on the internet is essentially the problem here. Like, even if Facebook and Twitter have their own rules, if they weren't so big and so massive, and there was actually proper competition, even there you would have issues with people, posting really kind of horrible stuff quite frequently.
It's a tricky one, and I think you're right. The internet is such a big old thing that you know, getting into every corner of it, seeing what's happening in every corner of the internet, as a regulator is impossible. It's definitely way beyond any sort of regulatory framework body that we have today. But then, you know, what is the internet? If you know, go back 20, 30 years when this thing was in its infancy, it was supposed to be the place where you could say anything you liked. It was supposed to be the place where, you know, where the free exchange of ideas would take place. And you know, the companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook were champions of that. You know, they were anti-censor companies, and now they're censors. It's gone wrong.
Well, exactly, which seems to lead to the answer to that question, being social media should be self-regulated. It shouldn't be an external regulator which is in charge of regulating what is said on the internet. And the change needs to come in education, in what these platforms are actually for, in what people read from these platforms. The amount of data and the amount of information out there now is beyond the realm of regulation. It is too big to regulate. So in order to actually safeguard people from the dangers of social media, which we can see all over the place, including in the recent Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma, which some of the stats are just horrifying, it should be potentially individuals' responsibility to protect their children, protect vulnerable people from the dangers of social media. And that comes from better education rather than tighter regulation, perhaps.
From an investor perspective, it's more appealing if a platform does have proper regulation that works effectively, because you don't want your adverts coming up next to like Nazi propaganda on Facebook. That's not something, it's hard to sell that space. And it's not great for the business. So in that sense, it could be that it might be worth arguing that the most PC platforms make for the best investments. It's a big statement, but it could be true.
But don't people like, as you've been discussing in your magazine column, your magazine article that's coming out in this week's issue, people like controversial content. This stuff sells. People like a good old scrap on the internet or something unsavoury.
They do. I think controversial content is great for engagement because as I explained in that article, it kind of triggers an emotional response and then gets people writing about it and sharing it. But equally, content that is kind of sedates the viewer is more popular usually than controversial content. Like of the most followed pages on Facebook, I think only around 3 or 4 are actually related to current affairs, and a couple of them are Chinese. So they're completely like disconnected from whatever just happened in Washington. Most people, well, not most people, but I think more people than maybe some people assume are not that interested in politics and just want to watch soap cutting videos and ASMR videos and cat videos on the internet and not actually fussed about political forums on Reddit. So, yeah, I suppose in that sense, again, I think kind of mind-numbing content is more investor-friendly than controversial content.
Which begs the question, I suppose, what is the platform for? If it's for selling advertising, then the mind-numbing content is the stuff that is more important, more valuable. But if it is for broadcasting content and ideas, which it seems to be doing more of, even though, as you say, the volume of content and what attracts the biggest number of users is the mind-numbing content, but the volume of content which is capturing headlines is the controversial stuff. If that's the purpose of social media, then maybe it does need some form of regulation. That suggests it's a broadcaster rather than a platform for advertising or anything else.
Indeed. I mean, Lauren, you mentioned, and Megan, you just mentioned advertising. We know that Google, for example, runs advertising through its sponsored searches, sponsored links, for financial scams. And a very active campaigner in the UK, a guy called Mark Tabor, has been on at them and the FCA, the financial regulator in the city, to do something about this, and Google refuse. You know, they say we're not there to censor advertising either. So you know, I feel that the social media industry has got to a point where they want to have their cake and eat it, and I don't think that's sustainable.
No, it's almost certainly not. And the regulators, especially on the big company side, are certainly circulating. But if we're talking about regulators on the media side, then they're a little bit further off the pace, and that leads to the final question. Are the regulators of the mainstream media getting it right? What do you think, Lauren?
Again, it's a difficult question because it's kind of the same issue. It's how do you get your arms around broadcast media and online media? And you certainly can't treat them like they're the same thing. This is kind of doubling back to an earlier question, but with Trump, people are claiming that Trump has been censored. He hasn't really been censored. He still has access to the presidential pulpit and he can ring up Fox News whenever he wants. And that's the most viewed news network in America. So yeah, it's kind of, you can't, just because you regulate one form of media, i.e. online, doesn't mean that you can regulate the other one effectively and vice versa.
I think I know your answer to this question.
I'm not a big fan of Ofcom. That's what you're asking. With specific reference to the UK, some of the particularly around reporting of the coronavirus pandemic, some of the Ofcom guidelines I have found to be extremely strange indeed. And I find myself watching telly without any real view of what's going on, feeling that the way that mainstream media regulation is working is that I'm not being told stuff.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that one. I think in the US as well, the regulation around mainstream media is questionable, to say the very least. So if the media regulators are going to start looking at the social media platforms in the same way as they're looking at the mainstream media, I don't think that's really going to help very much.
It's all very difficult. I mean, you know, just my sort of 1,000-foot, you know, personal view of everything is I don't like censorship. I really don't. I think, you know, censorship never got us anywhere. I mean, there are people who say things that are appalling, and probably they shouldn't say it. But society will out them, as it were, But you know, give someone the opportunity to say that and let society do that. You know, I think that's important.
Which is why education is, and filling the gap in people's knowledge is potentially more important than regulation is.
Yeah, also teaching people how to interpret what's on social media, how to use various media platforms, how to understand the biases that are inherent in personal views on social media or mainstream media, news reporting. The article you mentioned is all about the protection of children on social media platforms. And I maybe that's a place to start. Mm. And educating the youngest, most vulnerable people about how to actually work with these platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly a subject which invokes powerful emotions on all sides. Most people, regardless of their level of subject matter, do have a view on Trump and on Twitter. But to get an expert view on this subject, our producer, John Rogers, has spoken to Professor Charlie Beckett from the London School of Economics. He's the founding director of POLIS, which is an international journalism think tank for the university, and he led the commission Truth, Trust and Technology in 2018, which is looking at ideas around regulation of information and the media. We began by asking him what his initial reaction was to the Trump ban.
Well, I think like many people, it was both, in a sense, a positive move because he was clearly a spreader of mis and disinformation and extremist content on that platform. But I was also, like many people, very concerned at the sort of arbitrary ad hoc nature of it, that it seems that the social networks and indeed people who are their critics are being very reactive. We see a problem and demand that something must be done. And if it's convenient for the tech companies, if it's in their interests, or if they're pushed hard enough, they will then take action. So it doesn't feel very well thought out. And there doesn't seem to be a sort of structural approach to dealing with the specific problems that are obviously arising.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Do you think then this potentially wouldn't have happened if it wasn't the case that perhaps, you know, Joe Biden's going to win the election, the Democrats are going to be, you know, take over power in the US? I mean, is that sort of what we can read into this?
It's partly that, of course. There's a sort of short-term political context for it. But even if you go back to, you know, when people in the West or when people in America started worrying about misinformation, it was around the election of Donald Trump. And I often wonder what would have happened if Hillary Clinton had won. Would people be so concerned? And it's very much in a US-driven agenda here that we've had populists spreading propaganda, people trying to manipulate or even censor the internet in other countries. But it only really becomes a matter of urgency because, of course, these are American companies largely. It only becomes a matter of kind of policy urgency when it happens at a very high profile, mainly in America. And I don't think that's very healthy when you think of the incredible impact that all these networks have around the world. And so, you know, we're seeing, which is interesting, we're seeing a variety of responses in the European Union, you know, certain countries in the EU itself. Is adopting a slightly more coherent approach, but it's still kind of iterative, it's reactive. And that's partly, I think, because it's an incredibly difficult set of issues to tackle.
Yeah, it seems like regulation for social media kind of lags behind, or it's non-existent in some cases. There's a lot of self-regulation. What do you think is a better system? Do governments need to get involved with regulating these big social media companies?
I mean, in our commission in 2018, we had a very clear principle that, of course, you can regulate these platforms. They're like any other entity, any other company or institution can be subject to law or regulation or rules, but they are different. And we don't have the kind of regulatory principles, or certainly not the regulatory institutions in place that can deal with these organizations, because they are not just like publishers. Anybody who says there's a simple solution, which is break them up or treat them like newspapers or treat them like broadcasters, just doesn't understand the scale and nature and the differences between these different social networks. So I don't have a simple off-the-shelf solution. We suggested that we, first of all, need to know a lot more about what is actually happening on these networks. They don't even seem to know what's happening on their platforms, and they're not very transparent about telling us, let alone allowing some kind of accountability. So I think that a solution might be a kind of intermediary body. We suggested a kind of independent platform agency that would, first of all, have access to what's happening on those networks and be able to monitor what they're doing. And of course, they are already subject to some kind of regulatory oversight. They're not allowed to break the law in particular countries, for example. And they have to respond to the usual accountability mechanisms. That's why you saw Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill and other people at, you know, in front of House of Commons select committees. So I think that these networks are also changing. You know, 10 years ago, we all thought Facebook was marvelous because it helped fuel protest during the Arab Spring. We're now very worried because Facebook and the other networks also helped fuel the protests or the insurrection that we saw on Capitol Hill just recently. So getting the balance right is incredibly difficult anyway, but especially because these networks are constantly evolving. Literally, day by day, their algorithms are tweaked and adjusted. So how do you regulate that? How do you understand what's happening? And then how do you decide what they should and shouldn't do? These are very much a special case. And that's not to say that nothing should be done. I don't think laissez-faire is an option here. But anybody who tells you that there's a simple solution really doesn't understand what's happening.
Is there also an issue of maybe a monopoly on free speech held by the likes of, you know, I'm thinking of Twitter in particular. I mean, I heard that Parler had been sort of shut down off the back of this, and I have to admit, I'd never heard of Parler, but that seems, you know, like one alternative to Twitter that has now sort of been taken off the air. So I just wonder, is there an issue that too much, yeah, there's a monopoly basically in the hands of too few?
I don't think so. I think you can talk about, we used to talk about, you know, diversity of ownership in the news media, and there was always a balancing act that you didn't want one entity to have dominance. I don't think that any particular social network has a monopoly. You could argue that it has you know, kind of dominance or great significance. You have to remember that the social networks are part of a media ecosystem. So one of the problems around extreme speech is that it doesn't just happen online. There are cable channels who are also rather vociferous, and mainstream media generally can often amplify what's happening online. And if you try to you know, break up the networking giants, well, in a sense, they are already doing that themselves. They're devolving into Instagram and WhatsApp and other channels, which are often more private, more closed, and even harder to know what's going on and to regulate them. And ultimately, as we saw with Parler, if people don't feel that they can speak on a certain platform, they often go off to find their own, which again will be more secretive, more closed. I don't think it's a solution to just say, you know, break up the tech giants. I think that in some senses, it's quite useful having quite dominant social networks because you know where they live and you can go along and ask them to behave. And I think that is partly the kind of negotiation that we're seeing across the world right now.
It's not just political discussion which has been under the spotlight of the media regulators, as you mentioned, John, here in the UK, where politics is for now quite a lot calmer than it is in the US. The big topic up for debate is coronavirus. So sparked, I suppose, by the banning of talk radio from YouTube, which only lasted for half a day, but yeah, it wasn't It wasn't ideal, the situation that evolved there. Lauren, do you want to just talk us through what happened?
Yeah, so the talk radio channel was banned for, yeah, as you say, half a day because of a doctor's comments that we should let the pandemic spread after the lockdown announcement. And the host called it an injection of common sense. But yeah, it was obviously questionable material. But equally, you can make the argument that we should be able to have discussions about public health policies in a public forum. And especially given, I mean, you know, whether or not you're a proponent of lockdown, this government has not exactly made itself look good over the past 9 months or so. And we should be able to criticise that in a public way. Yeah, discussion of that certainly shouldn't be squashed.
I agree, which is why I made my earlier comments about Ofcom. We've got their guidelines here. What they say is that accuracy or material misleadingness in programmes in relation to the virus or public policy regarding it is banned, essentially, on mainstream media. Now, I have a problem with that, because who's telling me what's right? And what aspects of government public health policy are correct? Because it seems to be moving around all the time, and I don't really understand the basis upon which a lot of decisions have been made.
Absolutely, I completely agree with you, but just in the interest of fairness, it wasn't actually Ofcom which took this this talk radio thing off YouTube. This was actually YouTube, which has really shot itself in the foot by doing this, because YouTube says that in its rules that it doesn't allow content about COVID-19 that poses a serious risk of egregious harm. Which is a little ironic, given that YouTube is still hosting the video in which Donald Trump says this.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that.
But yeah, Ofcom as well, absolutely, it's hard to deny, has been censoring conversation around coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, take this doctor who said, you know, you should let the pandemic spread post-lockdown. Well, you know, that was up for debate. That was actually government policy, if I remember rightly, at the beginning of this whole thing. This is the whole herd immunity strategy. You know, we had the Barrington Declaration, which was made by a number of other scientists who...
And was taken off Google.
Was taken off Google. I've never really ever seen it talked about in any mainstream TV outlet. We've actually given them some space in the magazine. It was we interviewed Dr. Sunetra Gupta. But, you know, why shouldn't we listen to her view? She's a scientist. As much as anybody on the government's advisory side of things are scientists as well, I want to hear both sides of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually what... A lot of the articles that you do read in the mainstream media, which cover the Great Barrington Declaration, are hugely critical of what these scientists have done. And some of the terminology that they've used to describe the scientists is, I mean, it's disgusting considering that these are professionals who have a scientifically backed up view on lockdown, and they're being spoken about as if they're monsters.
Yeah,
I think the issue with the talk radio thing was the fact that the journalist, that the host, had agreed with the doctor. He had said that this was an injection of common sense. Not something that I don't necessarily disagree with myself, but and YouTube had said there was no challenging of the statement, no balance. But there. There's plenty of balance elsewhere around the internet, that the internet has to have arguments on both sides. And the host, in agreeing with a doctor, with a professional on whether or not we need to go back to the herd immunity thing, isn't something that should be silenced, and certainly not by YouTube.
I mean, the whole agreeing thing, I think, is quite interesting, because, you know, something I haven't actually heard anyone talk about it during the recent discussions about social media, but it's this idea of echo chambers, that everyone sort of gravitates to the area, the forum, the whatever it is, the channel, where the people agree with them. And so you end up with these big bubbles of people agreeing with each other. And actually, people disagreeing with each other is what makes things better. it's, you know, not necessarily, you know, full-blown conflicts, but actually, you know, debating and challenging and working towards better answers.
Absolutely, yeah. There's certainly no denying that. maybe the argument for now is keep everything calm, keep it all quiet, stick with the policy, don't stir things up. But what if that policy making is incorrect?
We might make things worse.
Yeah.
So it's a bit, yeah. It's quite interesting. Yeah, as you can tell, I sort of do feel quite strongly about this.
Yeah, so do I. And I think the more space we can give to the people who are being silenced by other areas of media, the better. Anyone, all voices welcome at the Investors Chronicle.
Absolutely.
But yeah, this does all tie into what the outlook is. Obviously, we are an investment publication at heart, not a political forum. But so tying it back to what this means for the big social media companies, it does suggest that turbulence is coming down the road for Google, for Facebook, for Twitter. Lauren, you pointed out in your article that Twitter has stopped even reporting how many users it has on its platform because they're not heading in the right direction. This doesn't make for a great investment case.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. I mean, Twitter's kind of a separate issue because Twitter's got a chief executive who's not really paying close attention. Yeah, it's not great. It's not been a great business for a couple of years now. But more widely on kind of Facebook and Twitter and other social media networks, they for a long time they've kind of enjoyed legal freedoms because of laws back in the 90s that has made them basically not liable for any content that's published on their platforms by third parties, which has been great for them. I mean, that's kind of perfect. But there's been bipartisan support for those laws either being scrapped or reformed in some way, and they do need to be changed. I mean, yeah, like 30 years ago now, the internet's come so far. And they were designed to help those companies get bigger. And I think most people would agree that they're big enough now. They need to... I think they're starting to take baby steps in accepting whether or not they like it, that they're publishers. And now I think regulators need to kind of push them further along that journey.
Mm. And meanwhile, they have the antitrust arguments floating around as well. The fact that Google and Facebook have the two largest antitrust cases in history that they're going to have to fight probably over the next decade, but that doesn't really play into play in their favour at all if the wider space, if the regulators are looking at anything to get their hands on, if antitrust laws are going to change as well. There's a lot of problems potentially for the companies which rely on.
Yeah, definitely. It's like if Twitter and Facebook weren't so big, the fact that Trump got kicked off them wouldn't be such an issue. I mean, at the core of it, it's because they've been allowed to get so massive, and Facebook was allowed to buy Instagram and WhatsApp. Is that Twitter and or Facebook, neither of them should be equated with free speech because they shouldn't be the biggest platforms on the internet, but they are. It's just opened up. It's opened them up to scrutiny to antitrust regulators again. So this doesn't look good from a competitive perspective.
They're also just hypocrites. And when we go back to you know the November election, another piece you wrote about U.S. election spending on social media platforms, Facebook was quite happy to take Donald Trump's money and sell him advertising space. Quite happy to do it. So there is a huge degree of hypocrisy at the heart of all this.
And this is without even mentioning TikTok, which has all sorts of its own issues to contend with. I was listening to a very interesting podcast about TikTok the other day, which was saying that, I mean, the amount of time and energy which has been spent on the regulation of TikTok because of these concerns about the fact that the Chinese may get hold of our data is really not significant at all, considering how much data Google and Facebook have on all of us. And Twitter has the odd dance video. TikTok has the odd dance video. It's really not really a significant thing in the grand scheme of data privacy and big tech regulation.
No, but TikTok was easy to go after.
Exactly, yeah.
I suppose also the difference there is that with Facebook Apple and Google and whoever else, I don't think there's been much of a precedent with them sharing data with the state, whereas with Jack Ma and Alibaba and kind of in the world of Chinese tech companies, which include TikTok, owned by ByteDance. There have been some reports that the Chinese government is pushing Jack Ma to share some of the consumer data that his company has collected. So, yeah, there is perhaps more concern warranted over TikTok than there is over Google.
Yeah, concern for a different reason, which I suppose is something that maybe we should talk about another time, because we've definitely run over the 15-minute slot allotted to us by our producer. Sorry about that, John. So we'll wrap it up, but I think antitrust and TikTok and China are probably two topics that we can explore in later podcasts, so stay tuned.
We're going to be doing Bitcoin as well, aren't we, soon?
Yep,
Bitcoin or crypto, which seems to be what old Twitter Jack is more interested in than anything these days.
Yeah. Maybe that's why he's taking time off the ball a bit. He's going to make all his money in Bitcoin.
Along with everybody else.
A discussion for another week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.